Today's guest is Alison, or Ali Davies, from Oh My Musical Goodness. I am stoked to have Ali on as a guest. There was a weird bunch of circumstances that led us to doing a very last minute episode together. We recorded this yesterday, so it's very fresh. And I'm so glad we did it. Ali has, you know, she was recently diagnosed with autism. She had a bit of a meltdown, I guess, and needed to move away from her private practice as a music therapist, and has gone on this really amazing ride of changing her business model, and now she's really focused on brain care. And we have this really great conversation. You know, a lot of the stuff we talk about today is about reducing overwhelm and, you know, for me, some really great tips for anxiety. You know, I think we're all really at capacity and need to create some space. So this episode is absolutely for you if you are like pretty much everyone. So I'm saying if you probably are dealing with overwhelm, probably different levels of overwhelm on a day-to-day basis and anxiety, this interview is going to be an absolute gift. I'm stoked that Ali found her way into my life, and I'm really privileged to be able to sit down with her for an hour, because this chick is going places, and watch this space for sure. So let me just stop rabbiting on and introduce you to the amazing Ali Davies. Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
There's only one story that, like, can really tell you when I'm thinking about myself and my life. It has absolutely blasted my life apart in the last year, and that is that a year ago I was diagnosed with autism. And I would never in a million years have guessed that I was autistic, but that's because no one really knows that much about autism, and I don't fit the mold or sort of, you know, what everyone perceives as autism. And so when I discovered that a year ago, every single thing about my entire life that never made sense in one sitting, like I woke up in the middle of the night and sat bolt upright, and every single thing about my entire life that I've never understood just fell into place. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm autistic. This makes so much sense now. And then I went and I had a diagnosis and all that, and I'm like, yep, you're autistic. And it all makes sense. And since then, my life has been, that was the best moment of my, like, getting married and having children and all of that was wonderful. But this moment of me making sense to myself is still like the absolute biggest mind-blowingness moment of my entire life.
So let's talk about that, right? So what does it mean? What did it mean for you to, like, when you said that things just fell into place and they made sense, how could you explain that to someone who, okay. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yep, hearing you. Well, firstly, I was managing what I thought and everyone thought was postnatal depression, because, you know, like, I managed my life pretty well. Everything was going pretty well until I had kids, and then bam, you know, like all that noise, all that touching and all that nothing making sense. And I'm someone who, like, I can write a research, like, I can do a literature review and write an article and do, like, the heavy stuff. But, you know, the small things like packing a school bag or even just remembering to, like, anything, you know, the basic everyday things, they are hard for me. So enter parenthood into my life, and everything just became so hard. So I just imagined, and everyone sort of thought this was postnatal depression. I was having meltdowns. I was not remembering anything. I even started experiencing mutism. So I would go through stages where I literally just could not talk. And in my mind at this time, I was thinking, far out, this postnatal depression stuff is pretty crazy. But no one still had any, you know, postnatal depression can be anything. If you start not coping after you have kids, you're sort of thrown in the postnatal depression basket. So I was just trying to do lots of self-care. I was trying to just have baths and like talk about it, which is really hard when you're mute. my husband was coming. My husband was coming home early from work to do stuff, and he'd come and meet us in his lunch break. And I was just trying to do things like I was breaking up the day into things that had to be done. Like we would make muffins, and then we would do something, and we would do something, and then we'd get to meet my husband for lunch, and then we'd do something else. And I was trying to follow all these really scripted things just to get through the days, which was really hard because I find any kind of organizational stuff difficult. But all of this trying to do those things because I thought this is what you do for postnatal depression just made it harder. And the other thing that really I was not dealing with and hadn't my entire life was sensory overload. So when I had this big light bulb moment when I woke up in the middle of the night and realized I was autistic, one of the biggest things that fell into place for me was my sensory, I also have sensory processing disorder. And that means that my brain just can't integrate all of the sensory information that it gets. So especially noise and touch, tactile and auditory, they are two of my biggest triggers. And my brain literally cannot integrate that information. So if I hear something, it's like I can hear it and it just doesn't stop, and it causes physical pain. It feels like there's people slapping my face. And I've had that for my whole life, but I just assumed everyone did. And it's funny because I've been working, so the reason I was able to have this moment of self-realization is because I've worked in the area of autism and worked with autistic children for many years. I was actually touring around Australia teaching people about autism before I even knew I was autistic.
That's just insane.
And I still had absolutely no idea. If someone else had described this to me, I would have, you know, said straight away, you know, have you heard about autism? Like, but in my own life, because it's me, it just didn't even occur to me. It's crazy.
Totally crazy. So yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. I know. So what led you to what? So if we go back, right, pre-kids.
Yep.
How were you functioning pre-kids? So was the kids an overload to your senses? Yeah. So all the touch and all the noise really tipped you over?
Yeah, so sensory processing disorder and autism spectrum disorder are two separate things, mm-hmm. and they don't always go together. But the way I describe it to people now is that autism...
But you have first-hand experience.
Yeah, now that I know, autism is responsible for all the best bits about me that I love, like my personality, and sensory processing disorder is responsible for all the really difficult stuff that I really struggle with. So... when you're sensory overloaded, it exacerbates all of the autism stuff. Everyone's autism looks different. There's no such thing as, you know, people having the same kind of autism. It's all very varied. But in general, your brain functioning reduces when you're experiencing sensory overload. So the things that I'm predisposed to struggle with because I'm autistic just became heaps harder and heaps just affected by the sensory overload. So once I had kids, that all just went off the charts. Like, so I always sort of struggled at school in a way. Like, I loved to socialize. I loved school. I was kind of good at it, but there were certain things that I was really bad at. And in fact, I only found this out in recent times, but when I was 15, my school told my parents they thought I had a learning disability because literally I only knew my two times tables, my fives and my tens, you know, the ones that everyone knows. Like sixes and seven times tables, that stuff's like, who needs to know that?
Yeah, me too. Eights are like, what? What are you talking a different language?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's never going to be relevant in life. And so very, very, like, there were certain things that, very basic things that I'd been taught every year at school and still just did not understand. And there were certain, I was very, there were certain dietary things or foods that I just could not, if food was touching on a plate, like I could not eat it. It made me want to scream just looking at food touching on a plate. I had tactile stuff, like my clothes always felt like they were scratching me and I didn't want to wear them and I didn't want, you know, shoes and socks and all very things. Like if I was now, this might have been picked up as a child, but because I was a child in the 80s where Asperger's especially, no one knew anything about it. I think I would have always known this about me if I was sort of a little child now.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Yeah, totally. So what led you to the work that you do now? Because it wasn't personal before, but it feels like, well, it probably is more now.
Yeah, it is. I've just, like, so my work constantly is a changing journey, basically. So I'm a neurologic music therapist, and I started doing music therapy because I'd always done music. Now, this is interesting. So music, and I was doing music every day. I was playing the saxophone. I was singing. I was in orchestras and bands, and if I wasn't in the band, I was conducting the band. I was the school band captain. Such a geek.
I was going to say, dialogue. No, just kidding.
I was that one who would rather miss out the lunch break and go in the music room and practice for concert band. So, you know. So I was doing this all the time. And knowing what I know now, as a music therapist, my area of specialty is in how the brain responds to music. So I know that music gives your brain a real sense of order, and it activates so many different parts of your brain simultaneously so that your brain can function better. So just the act of me having a childhood and a lifetime full of doing music was really helping me to function in a way that potentially would have been heaps harder for me if I wasn't a musician. When I had kids, I was really, you know, sick during my pregnancies, and I stopped all music because I couldn't really do anything. So that was another reason why, even like I did have the sensory overload all of a sudden, but also I dropped my one thing that was keeping my brain on fire. Yeah.
So was it just the love of music that set you on the spiral?
Yeah.
Not the spiral, but the path that you're on now.
Yeah, the downward spiral?
Yeah, the spiral.
No, yeah, definitely. My dad, so my mum's quite musical. My dad is totally passionate about music. So literally my first words were out of a Fats Domino song. And I was I was like listening to mixed tapes as a baby that he'd made me. So heaps of rock and roll. Yeah, and my mum has a story that when I was a little kid, I was not very organized and I wasn't very practical, and I didn't make sense, I guess, a lot of the time. And one day she got exasperated with me and she said, "What goes on in your head, Alison?" And she said, I looked up at her and I said with all seriousness, "Nothing, Mum, just music. It's from when the moment I wake up, the music's playing and it's there till I go to sleep." And from that moment, she says, from that moment on, she vowed to help nurture that and to understand that that's what's going on in my head, and that I wasn't able to follow instructions very easily, but that's because that wasn't what my strength was. So they really, really encouraged and nurtured my brothers and I with our music.
So what's, yeah. So, you know, I guess for me, it's like the natural or the natural job choice would be to then go on to become a musician. So what led you instead to go down the therapy path with music instead of just, not just, but instead of going down the I'm a musician track to instead being a therapist?
Yeah. Well, the way I saw it when I got sort of time to decide what I was doing after school was that music was the only thing I really loved and was really good at. I knew that I didn't want to be a performer because I didn't think I could commit to that. And I didn't think I was good enough to be successful at it. And I didn't want to be a music teacher because I knew that I just didn't want to be in a school being a music teacher.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
I know. You have to really be passionate about that. And I'm not passionate enough So, yeah. So when I heard, I can't remember when I heard about music therapy, but as soon as I heard about it, I just knew, like, I love getting in people's, I love working out people, and I love analyzing them and working it out.
Me too.
And it fascinates me so much. And I was like, oh my gosh, I would love to be a therapist. And I didn't even really know what music therapy was. When I got to uni to do my Master of Music Therapy, they were talking about how music therapy is an allied health profession. And I was like, what? This is an actual health modality that I'm delving into. This is crazy. So I still, like, I didn't really even know what it was, but I just knew that it was what I wanted to do. And it was. It's like I've been a registered music therapist for about 12 years, and I've always, always felt that if I wasn't being paid to do this as my job, I would be doing it anyway as a volunteer or whatever. And I've never, ever, ever since being a music therapist gone, ah, damn, it's Monday tomorrow. Never.
That is cool.
Like, I just love my job. Yeah.
Have you ever been anything else work-wise?
Yeah, I haven't worked very well in any other kind of job environment. So I've had a few jobs where it's the full day kind of, you know, 8 to 5 type thing. And I've only ever lasted 10 months max in a job like that. I've worked in shops, and I've worked for Anglicare, and I've worked for, you know, just like all very like child-based youth programs and youth worker case management stuff with homeless children, or, you know, all sort of therapy-based stuff. But as a music therapist, I've only ever worked in private practice, so I've always kept my workload to a minimum. I'm happy with like 2-3 clients a day. That's like a few hours a day, and that keeps me happy. But having the long days has never worked for me. And I can see why now, but I just always thought that that's just my personality. Maybe I'm just lazy. I just always called myself lazy. Like, I literally could not deal with the thought of working more than 4 hours a day.
I know. I'm hearing you. Don't worry. So one question that is kind of coming into my mind about, you, like, when you said all the other jobs that you have had, I mean, the retail thing aside, even then it's, you know, there's a certain level of service that is involved in retail. The other jobs that you mentioned about, you know, being a youth worker and working with Anglicare, and like, they're all very service-based roles. So mm-hmm. Were you like a kid that was always looking out for other kids, or like, what, you know, that kind of,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, it's,
yeah,
like,
I know what you're
it's
saying.
A big heart that takes on roles like that. So were you always like that, or was that something, you know, was that something that you wanted to do, help others? And
yeah, I'm like, I feel like, in a way, if I can be a bit woo-woo about it,
you can be totally woo-woo. You're in a safe place here. We're all a bit woo.
It's definitely my soul's purpose. Not even my soul's purpose, but it's who I am, and something I could just put it down to, that's who I am, that's my personality, or I could put it down to the fact that a lot of girls or a lot of people, not just girls, who are autistic, there's this myth that we don't have empathy, and it's a total myth. In fact, the opposite is most likely true. And there's not a lot of research on this yet, but the opposite is most likely true, that there is so much empathy that it's very difficult to deal with it, and that's what causes this lack of emotional regulation and not being able to cope. I certainly do find that. I've always been, since as long as I can remember, totally all about social justice, fairness, and what's right. And I recall as a child just sitting on the floor of my bedroom often and looking around and crying because I had so much and I felt so privileged, even as a primary school kid, knowing that there were children in the world who didn't have homes and toys. And that's been definitely a pervasive theme about who I am and what I believe in. And it's the only, I'm so passionate about it that it makes my job, or the jobs that I've had, not even really a job, just real. I was a carer for a while when I was at uni, and I just loved going in and getting people out of bed and getting them dressed and cutting up their breakfast and feeding them and just doing that real life servicey stuff.
Yeah, that's super cool. I relate to the social justice thing too, because, you know, as a kid, I was always selling lemons or, you know, selling toys on the lawn, raising money for different charities and stuff. And, you know, and as a kid in the 80s, I mean, we saw Ethiopia and, you know, all the atrocities of the world on TV. We were the first generation to really see that stuff. And, yeah, it hit me hard too. But I just, yeah, I just really admire the path you've gone down. So a question in regards to the music therapy, is it, so have you found yourself specializing kind of in autism or, you know, was that intentional? Is it primarily driven towards that area or, you know, what different areas do music therapists cover and how did you find yourself kind of falling into this role that you're in now?
Yep. Okay. So music therapists work across a whole spectrum of, hospitals, very clinical, also in education, also in community care. Personally, I've had most of my career working in either early intervention, which is 0 to 4 year olds, working in early childhood development, and in aged care and dementia care. So they've been my main two areas. And I got to a point after I had kids that I really knew that because my life was going to the shit, basically, because I wasn't coping with anything and I thought it was postnatal depression, I was like, right, what do I really want from my work? And I had to decide. And what I decided was, well, firstly, I just need to focus on one area and I want to get in. I want to get into that area and I want to research and I want to do a PhD and I want to just get in there and make change. So I started just focusing more on aged care, dementia care, because I was so passionate about dementia care and palliative care and how people with dementia is a terminal condition, yet there's no specific palliative care approaches for people with dementia. So that was what I was, that's what I was doing. And then I sort of realized that what I loved about this whole dementia care world and the stuff I was doing, that it was just so interesting how the brain works and how by doing such simple music-based stuff with people, we were really making not long-term functional changes in their brain, but really helping open them up to things like they can't speak, but they can sing You Are My Sunshine. Mm. And I loved being part of that.
Yeah.
It was incredible. So we'd have concerts where we'd invite all the families in. There's all these people who can't speak anymore. It's like in an actual choir. And it's mind-blowing.
That is amazing.
And so I just became fascinated with the brain. Not long after that, I had like 6 families in 1 week contact me. And I wasn't working specifically in autism at that point, but I had 6 families in the 1 week all contact me and say, hey, I heard you're a music therapist in town. My child's autistic. Can we do something? And it all happened all, and I just sort of took that as a sign, you know, the woo-woo in me again. Mm-hmm. I was like, right, it's a sign. Let's do autism. So even though I'd told myself I was going to focus on one area, I started this new program and I started seeing individual clients, children, autistic children. I was seeing them once a week for half an hour or an hour. And over time, I realized that the therapy model that I'd been doing my entire working career, I started doubting it and thinking, hang on, like, these people have, like, say, 4 therapists. They go to a speech therapist, they're going to a psych, the music therapist, they're going from appointment to appointment once a week for half an hour. Like, is there a better way? Because what I'm doing with them in the session, like, then what happens for the rest of the week? How is this improving their life? And I started to question it, and I came to sort of the realization that what I wanted to do was not do the therapy sessions, but educate the parents so that they can make changes and they can do stuff at home, so they're not constantly just going to therapy sessions. And I wanted to explain to them about how the brain works, because I'd had all these amazing years of seeing how effective music is at helping the brain function. And you don't have to be musical to do a lot of it. You just have to understand that it works. So, yeah, then I developed a workshop and I decided to just travel around and teach teachers and parents how to use music and how the brain works and why it works and what they can be doing at home. So I switched my model of work completely. And now it's not specifically about autism. It's specifically about the brain, because no matter if it's a neurotypical brain or an autistic brain or an ADHD brain or an OCD brain, they all like the same things and they all dislike the same things, basically. Now I'm just talking about the brain all the time, the brain in general.
Fascinating.
So I've gone through. So it's constantly this evolving journey, but I really feel like now I'm at this place where, like, yep, this is my bag. I am totally over this. This is how I see the rest of my career focusing around this brain care and education about how we can support our brain.
Yeah, incredible. So I have a question, right? Because some of the things that you had mentioned earlier in the piece when you discovered that you were autistic were things like the sensory overload stuff, or I guess that's a separate, they're two separate conditions, right? So with the sensory overload stuff, a lot of stuff that you were saying, I resonate with through my anxiety. So, you know, I speak a lot about, you know, having bouts of anxiety and the way, and actually I listened to the episode that you did with Lisa. And mm-hmm. I was just like, wow, so much of the stuff that you were saying was like, oh my God, that it makes so much sense. That just the night before I was having a conversation with my husband and he was saying to me, it's something ridiculously simple, like it's my birthday, I'm having my 40th party and we needed to figure out what we were going to do with Mabel after dark, like who would she go with? And Miko has this thing where he comes at me with all the different possible scenarios. Oh, well, we could get mum to look after her, or we could do this, or we could do this, or we could do this, and this, and then this, and this. And I'm just like, you just got to figure this out.
Yeah.
And he gets angry at me because he's like, well, we're just talking about this. And it's like, no, you're just confusing me and I don't know what to do now.
Yep. The paradox of choice.
Yeah, the paradox of choice. It's a real thing. I get overwhelmed very easily by too much choice. And he laughs at me when we go to a restaurant and I'm looking at the menu and I pick the first thing off the menu in about 5 seconds. And he says, are you sure that's what you want? Because you didn't really look at the menu. And I'm like, I can't look at the menu. That's why I picked something.
Yeah.
There's too many things.
It's funny because the research shows that the brain wants you to make the decision that's just good enough. The brain automatically is always aiming for the right decision or the best decision. That's why we get anxious when we have to make a decision. But good enough, if we can always make a good enough decision, the brain will be happy. So we need to switch our mind frame a bit.
From making the right decision to making a good enough decision.
Yeah, exactly. You're spot on, because we are all, you don't have to have sensory processing disorder to experience or live with constant sensory overload. We are basically all living in a state of sensory overload because we're living in an environment, in a home, in a school, in a workplace, in a community, society, in a country where there's just so much sensory, like just so much stuff. So much stuff making noise, so much stuff flashing before our eyes, so many toys, so many things, so many choices of what to wear, just so many choices of what to cook for dinner. And so the number of stuff and the number of choices we have creates processing overload where there are too many options for us to make sense and our brain starts to freak out a little bit because it's just got a constant barrage of decision making. And the brain was not developed to be an internet. The brain was developed to keep us alive. So since the beginning of time, our brain has been doing a very good job of keeping us alive. And then all of a sudden in the last 30 years, we totally change, we bring internet in and we change the whole, like we've completely changed what we're using our brain for. We want our brain to be our personal data system and to make decisions for us and to store information. And it just can't handle it. So we are all experiencing that processing overload, plus all the stuff that's around us is creating sensory overload. So basically, all of us are experiencing overload, and what manifests from overload is that your brain starts to feel chaotic, not make sense of what's going on, not have the power to make sense of all the messages that it's getting sent to it. And so it intentionally puts you into a state of fight or flight, which is what anxiety is. So we feel anxious in our body. It's our brain putting us into fight or flight because the brain can't make sense of the environment. So it's sort of telling us that, well, I can't be sure that you're not in a risky situation right now, and for your own benefit, I'm going to have to just get you on high alert so that if something pops up, you're able to save yourself. So we're all living in this high alert state.
Yeah, so it's funny.
It affects anxiety.
In the old days, not the old days, but say, 15 years ago, I could live in, and I guess we didn't have the phones and we didn't even have access to the internet all the time back then. So perhaps it was our load was lighter then, and I could deal with clothes on the floor and messiness. And really, I talk a lot about the fact that I'm very systems and procedures focused. For me, that's a coping mechanism because I can't deal with having driven out the driveway and then realizing I've left all the swimming gear on top of the roof of the car because I've been in such a panic to get out the door. So I create a system around it so that I don't feel the sense of panic that I do doing simple day-to-day things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know what my question is around that.
You know what? I think you're speaking for the masses there.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not very good at putting the system into place, but everyone is looking for an answer to keep them organized and to help them with that stuff. But again, 15 years ago, or imagine when we were children, right? Think of the 80s. I always try and think of what would have been happening in the 80s, apart from awesome clothes and awesome hair. we wouldn't have had so many after-school things. We wouldn't have had so many things to remember because mums didn't go into mums groups and go out for coffee every day. They just stayed at home and did the stuff. And we don't want that because we know what our options are now, and our minds have been broadened, but it just brings us to the paradox of choice again. We've got so much going on and we just can't cope. No one can cope with the amount of choices and the amount of things we've got going on. So we all do stuff like forget the things because our brain just literally can't do it all. It's working on overdrive in one area. It's going to drop the load a bit in another area.
Yeah. So what are things that we could do to lighten that load? Obviously clean up our space would be one. Maybe try and pull back on the things that we're committed to.
Sensory management is my biggest thing that I'd like to talk about because we all have the power to a certain extent over our environment, especially in our own homes at least. We might not have the power over our schools or our workplaces, but we do have a lot of power in terms of our own homes in how we can reduce what's in there. So decluttering is not just about, the simple living. I mean, it is, but also it's really good for your brain. It really clearing the amount of stuff that you can see and that is there all around you all the time, making noises or whatever it might be, really helps our brain out. It gives our brain less stuff to have to process, and then it can really focus on the important things. The other really great brain care technique is giving your brain things it likes. Now, the things that the brain loves are so simple and things that we sort of hear about all the time, but we don't think about them in terms of brain care and what's actually happening to our brain. So, for example, breathing, deep controlled breathing is great for our brain. And when we're doing anything that supports the brain, it functions better. So if you are doing deep controlled breathing, you're bringing oxygen into your body, oxygenated blood is going to your brain, and then your neurotransmission is happening better and you're making better decisions and you're remembering things and all those little functions that happen in there are improved. Not always, this is a general thing, but
But it's true, right? Before I get on an interview, it's like I take some deep breaths, and during the interview I'm mindful because, anxiety kicks in when you often when you can't control the outcome of something for me. So it's like, you know, I never really know. I mean, it's ironic because it's like I have a podcast which is totally free flow, which adds a level of anxiety. But because I love that as a concept, but then during it, I have to constantly be reminding myself to breathe and stay connected to the present. Like instead of thinking about where I'm going next, be present with where we're at in the conversation and trust and all those kind of, I guess they're not even really woo concepts. They sound woo when you say things like trust and surrender and being present. But really, they're really just simple techniques, right? It's like breathe so that you can be present, so that your brain's getting more oxygen, so that it can be present.
Exactly. And we've sort of lost, or maybe no one ever taught us, the actual science behind why we should be breathing. We hear all these just breathe kind of things, and we're like, you don't understand. My problem is past breathing. Breathing's not going to fix me. But that's because no one's actually telling us what's happening and how breathing actually is supporting our brain. And when we understand it in that way, which is why I want to teach people about it, when we understand how our brain functions and how we can support it and why that literally does help reduce our anxiety, like, we would all be doing it. Breathing is free and it's so quick and it's so easy. You don't need a therapist. You don't even need to go and look up breathing on YouTube to work out how to do it. It's just there.
And we're doing it anyway, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're doing it. We just have to bring our attention and intention to what we're doing when we're breathing sometimes, rather than just being on autopilot all the time. Yeah, because it's not often that we do. I mean, I definitely have it as a practice because it's been a tool for, you know, me moving through anxiety has been always about coming back to the breath and becoming present. So for me, it's a tool that I practice all the time, but mostly we're just unconsciously doing it, you know?
Exactly.
And I guess all, like, most of the simple tips and things that we can do to ease the mental load are just as simple as that, right?
Yeah. So anything, it's like self-awareness is an enormous thing. If you are aware of what is making you feel good, okay, probably not alcohol or drugs, although, you know, some
they make
alcohol,
you good temporarily.
But if you can put the idea of alcohol or drugs or anything else that's potentially risky aside and just think of the small things like listening to music. So listening to music evokes emotions. And
yeah. So sorry to interrupt you for one second. I remember when I was in the depths of a depression and hideous levels of anxiety, I went to a shopping center and there was a kids' choir. It wasn't a choir, it was like an orchestra playing. And I walked in and it was so overwhelming for me that I started crying on the spot. Because the music, I don't know, moved me in a way that happens rarely, you know, when you're totally covered in goosebumps. But this, but at this time, that level of intensity in music was too much for me.
Yeah, so that definitely happens. The brain, so music, when we listen to music, more parts of the brain are simultaneously activated than when you do any other thing ever. So music activates so many parts. Everything is on fire. So if you, and I always say we all have pent-upted sad.
Yeah.
Like it's just constantly penting up every day.
Yeah.
Just moments of, what? Or moments of like something frustrating, something sad, whatever it is. It's just moments of pent-upedness. And it's there and there, and it's just building up and building up until there's a trigger or an outlet for it. And if you hear a powerful, if you hear a song that, and music also is very linked to memory. So emotion is linked to memory and vice versa. Memory is linked to emotion. So they often come at the same time. And you might not be aware of whether it's memory or it's emotion or whatever it's triggering, but it can trigger a part of you that is so deep and one of those really primal, emotive, powerful forces within us that it just, it creates, it allows for an outlet of expression. And it doesn't just allow for it. It just bombards you.
Yeah, I wasn't allowing it. It was happening to me.
Your body is literally flooded with emotion in that scenario that you just told me. And when you have so much pent-upness in you, it's going to come out, and it is probably unfortunate if it happens in the supermarket or the shopping center.
Yeah.
But when you can do that on purpose, put that song on. For me, it's Pearl Jam, because as a grungy teenager, I loved it. When I listen to Pearl Jam now, I just go straight back to that feeling of being a free teenager, and I will strategically listen to Pearl Jam when I'm by myself, because I know that I'm going to have some pent-upness in me. If I listen to something that's going to evoke emotion, I do it strategically at home so I can have the big outpouring. You know, when we listen to sad love songs when we're feeling sad, and we listen to them 5 times in a row so we can have a big cry?
Yeah.
Like, we should do that strategically or whenever we need to.
Totally. I feel like, you know, I speak about this a lot about when, you know, through my depression, it always felt like, for me, it was a suppression of emotions. So I suppressed and I suppressed and I suppressed and I choked back the tears and I swallowed my anger and I swallowed the sadness until it got to this point where it was literally at my throat. And that was really when I, you know, I fell into a depression. It was just like the suppression, and at some point it had to depress. And I guess music is a great way to do that. I'd never really thought about that, but it would have been exactly what I needed at that time to release all of that, not negative, but all of those, emotions that I'd been swallowing, good and bad. Because in the culture that we're in today, it's not only is crying not necessarily acceptable or bad feelings, you know, swallow them, but it's also don't get too excited. It's both levels. It's like we're kind of trying to cut off the feeling at the extremes.
We are such a suppressive Australia, especially not even just the Western world, but for something about Australia, like don't show your emotion. Don't get too proud of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be teaching our children this, because no one told us that so when you're in that space where you were depression, it was just building up and up and you were just immersed in it. What happens when that's going on is that your executive functioning is impaired, and that your executive functioning is where you rationalize and make sense of things. And when your executive functioning is impaired, you don't have the ability to go, hey, hang on, I know, if I can just give myself an outlet for expression, I'm going to be able to externalize some of this stuff and I might feel better. No, like, you can't think that straight when you're depressed. So you just linger in this depression, not because you want to, but because you can't see any way out, because you can't think straight.
And even often when we're even given the solutions as to what to do, you know, I remember doing group therapy and a guy in the therapy in the group was told, you know, all you got to do is just take your medication. And he's like, well, I can't remember to take it. And they're like, you know, in the group, we were like, well, do you drink a coffee every morning? Yeah. We'll just put your tablets next to there. But there was something in him that wasn't even going to allow that to occur, to make it that simple. It just couldn't be that simple, you know? Yep. Because, and I think that's a key thing, right, when you're in that kind of place, is it's so easy to say, well, just breathe and go for a walk on the beach and meditate and eat well and blah, blah. But when you're in that space, it's so hard to do those things.
Exactly, I experience that all the time. Since I've had all this clarity about autism and sensory processing disorder, I continue to have meltdowns and anxiety and all the things that, you know, I think most of us secretly have but probably don't talk about. Mm. Mine's just related, autistic related. You know, it doesn't matter the biology of it. Mine's autism. Mine might be sensory overload. Yours might be anxiety related to something else. Someone else's might be related to a trauma or whatever it might be. It's all the same thing in our brain and our body. So we're all experiencing it. And we can continue to, but what I truly believe is that at the end of every meltdown or at the end of every, you know, week that is just terrible or whatever it might be, at the end of that, all the shit is out. I've expressed, you know, I've shrieked or screamed or cried or whatever I've needed to do, and it's out, and I might be exhausted and I might be feeling like a bit of a loser, but I am at the perfect place to start managing my life again.
Yes.
So I try and really like tell people that the stage in between a meltdown or the stage in between a breakdown or whatever it is for you is your management stage. Don't worry about trying to do this stuff while you're melting down. Just every in your normal day-to-day when things are going on their normal routine, that's when you manage your lifestyle. And you'll find hopefully that the management stage gets longer and the meltdown or breakdown stage gets fewer and further between and hopefully less severe.
Yes.
And that's the journey.
Totally.
Yeah. Oh,
I love it.
I feel like I want to cry now.
You know what? I love it because that is so true, right? So many years ago, I was so pent up and so disconnected from my own feelings. The last 10 years or so have been a process of me really figuring all that out, you know, and moving through it and recognizing that feelings are okay. We don't have to be afraid of them. And for me, it's like the embracing of that. If I'm feeling really angry, getting in the car and driving while I'm just screaming bloody murder, I move through it so quick.
Yeah.
And on the other side is space and peace.
Yes.
But so often we're trying to resist the feeling, where if we just move through it, it's okay.
Yeah. Because we're always, I mean, we have to have ups and downs or we would be just really bored and we wouldn't know what our ups were, how good our ups were. I mean, we're all going to do that. So instead of trying to avoid the depression and avoid the, I mean, just in our mindset, ultimately we do want to avoid that stuff. But if in our minds we can switch it to think about just reducing and managing, we wouldn't be so annoyed at ourselves when the depression comes back, and we wouldn't feel like such a failure or guilty or a bad parent or whatever it might be if we just accept that it's a part of our life and just manage it and just know that everyone else is trying to manage it too.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, particularly I can't speak for any other conditions, but for depression certainly, like, you just feel so alone, you know, you really do feel like you're in a dark hole and no one else gets it. And it's just really comforting to know that other people have their own dark holes, you know?
Yeah.
And that sounds depressing as fuck, but it's really not right. It's just acceptance of what is.
I want to say one more thing about that as well. We are constantly hearing from every side that we need to talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. And are you okay? And let's talk. And I think that those things come from people who aren't experiencing this because when you're feeling depressed or anxiety or anxious or whatever it might be, talking is so hard. There's only a tiny, tiny, tiny part of our brain that's responsible for talking. It's not like there's multiple areas in our brain helping this function. So it's one tiny place. And if our brain is not working at its best, talking is like the hardest thing you could ask someone to do. And there's not enough words in the English language to describe. Like I explained to one of my psychs, because I have a few, I explained to one of them one day that the only way I could possibly talk about how I'm feeling is if I stood on the top of the highest mountain in the entire world with the biggest, like one of those speakers that amplified my voice times a million and just screamed. Like there's not a word that conveys any of that. Because I know of the power of outlets of expression, I know that if I did stand on a mountain and scream, it would be so bloody healthy for me. So that's why instead of trying to talk about it all the time, I try and make sure I give myself all these outlets for expression, because that those feelings don't internalize and just dissolve. They need to be that you need to get them out of your body. You need to externalize that, and screaming, swearing, shrieking, wailing, panting, huffing, sighing, those things are gold for getting the pent-upness out of your body.
Totally. Oh, I love it. Yes. I had one experience where I went to a sound healing circle thing that a friend of mine was running, and it was an incredible experience. But one moment in the workshop, she had drawn a well on the ground, and we all had to have our turn screaming into the well. And I did it. And I just said to myself, you know what, Carly, you hardly ever go all in on something. I just go all in on this. Like, give it your all. And so I did. I just screamed. And I screamed like I've never screamed before. And it was the most bizarre experience because I was, this sounds really weird, but it was like I broke the sound barrier or something and I was me, but I was also me in like 10 million lifetimes before. It was like all of time stopped existing and there I was screaming. It was the most bizarre thing. And then from there, after I stopped screaming, I just naturally moved into crying and I bawled my heart out like I've never cried before. And then I started laughing like it was the funniest thing in the world. And when I finished, everyone in the room clapped because I had just really fully gone for it. And it was the most therapeutic thing ever because I let it out, you know, and we're so often just trying to analyze and trying to intellectualize what we're going through when sometimes we just got to feel it, like the depths of it, and be okay with that, knowing that it's going to pass and that we're safe, you know.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm totally all about those kinds of experiences.
Love it.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's On the Couch.
Biggest fear?
Oh, that I won't survive parenthood. Or young children. Let's just take it. Let's minimize that I won't survive the toddler or the young children age.
Yeah, it does feel forever and surprisingly ridiculously fast at the same time.
I know. Yes, it's one day at a time. I just do it. Take it one day at a time.
That's it. That's it. Struggle. What are you struggling with at the moment?
I struggle with keeping my thoughts in order and so actioning, knowing what needs doing and being able to do that without just getting overwhelmed by one thing needs doing and then I get overwhelmed by 1,000 things that aren't even relevant in that moment. I very struggle to really just get through moments of time without getting overwhelmed.
Yeah, I hear you. we all have the evil bitch in our head. What do you hear yours say the most?
Oh, that is such a good question. I don't know. What does your evil bitch say? Can I put that back on you?
Well, it's changed. You know, mine has definitely changed. I feel like before it was always around you're not enough, you know, what are you doing? People will think you're a dickhead. That was one for a very long time. Right now, it's probably it's not possible.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's good that it's not about you anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry, now I'm turning into therapist, aren't I?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know. I guess mine is very much like you don't know enough to be – I don't know enough to be trying to teach people. I think that's what mine is. And what will other people think of you when they realize you don't know enough?
Oh, yeah, that old chestnut. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Failure. What does failure mean to you? And how does it show up?
My ultimate fear of failure or thought about failure is that I get through life and realize that I just haven't done the things I wanted to do. So I don't really feel like I've experienced any of that yet. I fear in my life is more about a thought that it might happen more than something that I've already experienced. Yeah, just the thought of getting through life and not having regrets, that to me is what that is, yeah.
Yeah. So on the other side of that, on the flip side, what is success? What does success mean to you? What does it look like?
Oh, that's changed. That's definitely changed over time. And since becoming a mum, that's completely changed. My idea of success now is experiencing mindfulness and just presence. So being completely content in the moment in what's happening. So it's nothing grand. It's just peace and contentedness, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Because we spend most of our life thinking it's about more than that. And it's about how other people see us and how, you know, the things that we have and the things that we do, when really it's just when you really cut back to it, that's what it's about for most people, right? It's success is being content and at peace.
Yeah, and I always would have thought contentedness wasn't enough.
I know, it sounds really, like such a limited word.
Yeah, like I don't want to be content. I want to be outrageously whatever it is. But when you really think about what the meaning of contentedness is, how can there be any more? To be completely content in the moment just means that everything is in balance, and that's my idea of success.
And lastly, freedom.
Oh, man, I love freedom so much. I miss freedom. My idea of freedom is to stop being so bogged down by what I feel other people's expectations are of me and what I need to do to be the right, to be good enough in other people's eyes or to be doing the right thing in other people's eyes. So just shedding external expectations, because that just makes me feel like I'm not meeting the expectations. And freedom, yeah, I don't know if that is anything I will be able to do in this lifetime, because that is one of my big things. I can't help it. I always am not consumed, but I find it very difficult to honestly, genuinely not care about what other people think.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
Well, you can find me at Oh My Musical Goodness. You can find me on Facebook or Instagram. Probably go to Facebook. That's where more stuff happens. But ohmymusicalgoodness.com is my website, and I have a shop there with some resources about the brain, some video resources about meltdowns, and about really interesting things that many, many, many children and grown-ups secretly experience. So, yeah, you can go over there and find out more about the brain.
The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
Okay, my takeaway is the same every time. Please, please, please start thinking about sensory management in your life. Even the simple stuff like reducing your home environment. But think about all the senses, like the noises around you. What noises can you remove from your life? The sights, what visual stuff can you remove? What screens can you remove? What toys can you remove? And just to cut the number of stuff down so we don't become overwhelmed by choice, like what books can we remove? So not just the annoying plastic bright toys, but all the things, the spices in the spice rack, the books, the things that we love collecting, what can we get rid of just to reduce the choice and reduce the stuff?
Yeah, I was just on a podcast interview before I jumped on with you, being interviewed for somebody else's podcast, and she was saying that she just, we're talking about this space idea, right, and creating space, and she had said she did a wardrobe cull and she removed 328 items of clothes.
What?
I know. And,
oh my goodness.
And the reasons that she was hanging on to some things. So she had these expensive designer clothes that she'd bought in New York, and it was like a $400 jacket. And she was like, and I was hanging on to this thing because it was like, it meant something in that moment in time. And so I was hanging on to it. And because it was an expensive brand and I'd spent a ridiculous amount of money on it, I just couldn't bring myself to let it go. But how ridiculous, because nobody ever knew that it was a $400 jacket because I never wore it and the tag is on the inside anyway, you know? Yep. And so we hang on to all this stuff due to maybe who we think will be in the stuff. I don't know. And then...
Yeah, and then every time she saw that jacket, she would have felt guilt because she's like, oh, that jacket was $400 and I never wear it.
Exactly.
So even just seeing it induces anxiety every single time. So by removing it, she's like reducing. She's removing one trigger. And if we, you know, there are so many triggers in our house for anxiety. We just start getting rid of them. We'll be less
anxious.
Isn't that
so true? It's like even just in the wardrobe sense, it's like, you know, you if you're anything like me and you've gone up and down in weight, you have clothes that trigger, oh, I want to get back to that body.
Yes. Yeah.
Or, you know, look at those fat clothes that I'm wearing right now. It's like everything produces, it's all stimulus, right? Everything is a stimulus. Yeah.
Yep. Yep, totally. Yeah.
And I guess that's a good place to start, right? Just in your undie drawer or in your wardrobe, just clearing some
shit out. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's easier to do this than to try and change our whole mind frame about, no, you know, I'm not going to feel bad about the dress that I don't fit into anymore. Because, you know, like we've got so many mind frames that we're trying to switch all the time that we just need to give our brain a break and just get rid of the triggers. And it's important to also be aware that these triggers aren't the problem. If we're getting anxious because of the clothes that we don't fit into or because of the $400 jacket or whatever, it's our brain that's not coping. The jacket is just the innocent bystander that is triggering your anxiety. So, and that's the same with people. That's the same with the bullies at school or the job or the relationship problem or any of the things that we think our anxiety is about.
The cash flow.
The cash flow is the trigger for your own brain and your own anxiety that your body is doing to itself.
And this is what I realized, right? Like over the previous 6 months to, you know, say a month ago, things started to really shift for me. but there was this time there where I was looking at my bank account and each week it would go back down to zero. And the panic that would raise in me and all the questioning of whether it was me, what was wrong with me, you know, I gave that zero a lot of power. And when I stopped, when I mentally said to myself, you know what, I have a choice as to how I respond to that zero, because the way that I'm responding to it actually isn't changing it from a zero.
Exactly. Totally. Yes. Yeah, it's not the cash flow, it's not the zero that's causing the anxiety. You've got the anxiety in your brain because your brain is not coping. and then zero just, you know. I hope that our children don't have this same problem, because no one has money in their wallets anymore anyway, so their idea of money is going to be less that money exists and more that money is just some kind of metaphoric thing that's on a computer screen. But also we come from an era where our parents didn't talk about money and didn't talk about, there was certain, you know, I don't know, religion, money and politics or something. And so money, sex. And that just gives it, sex. And so that gives it an edge, like that just creates us a tension, whether it's a good or a bad kind of tension, it creates a tension. And so it can be easily, those topics can easily trigger stuff in us. So money is triggering, but it's not the problem.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I've loved this chat. It's been thebomb.com.
I feel like I could talk to you all day.
I know. Well, we'll be doing it soon.
Yes. Oh, cool. That was great.
Thanks for tuning into Carlosophies. If you really dug this app, I'd love for you to share it with someone who you think might also dig it. Really helps me to spread the word. And if you'd like to get to know me a little better and see some in-between app thoughts and insights and be around some super cool people, join my Facebook tribe, Show Up Speak Up. Search Show Up Speak Up in Facebook or head to carlinimmo.com/tribe. Until next time, be real, be rad. Peace out.